Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
What's at the end of this case? How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Sure, with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all textual.
Welcome to episode 200 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. We have 2 for 200. No, not our predictions records. Pat posted this morning about our unusual or pretty high success, but rather the number of cases we cover today. Hard to believe we've been doing this as long as that, and we want to thank all of our listeners who tune in and check us out and provide feedback to us. We really do appreciate it.
As of this morning, we have 12,000 total listens.
That's great.
Which is an average of just over 60 an episode. So thank you very much.
Yep. And so today, the first case of two today is from the Seventh Circuit, Ido Hussam El Nahas versus 777 Partners LLC. And a second's from the Indiana Supreme Court, Purdue Farms Inc. versus L&B Transport LLC, U.S. Security Associates Inc., William Richardson, Jennifer Freeman, Brian Hill, Carl Nelson, and ABC Corporation. Turning to our first case, does a party waive its right to seek arbitration when it appears and answers a complaint in 3 rounds of discovery, but does not issue any discovery or file any motions and waits 14 months before raising the issue of arbitration? That is a central merits question presented in El Nahas versus 777 Partners LLC. But there's also a threshold question raising a motion to dismiss after the plaintiff reached a settlement agreement for an amount more than what the plaintiff could have recovered with another defendant through whom the claim against the appealing defendant was premised. Judge Easterbrook was not buying the mootness argument, citing to Campbell Ewald Company versus Gomez, 577 U.S. from 2016. Still doesn't have a page number, believe it or not, but that's how long it takes.
I'm glad you said it, because I was going to. Yeah. 8 years later, we still don't have a page number.
Yeah. Which, according to OEA, holds that, quote, an unaccepted settlement offer does not make a plaintiff's claim moot, end quote. We're not sure of its application in this case, if OEA is correct. Pat, tell us about this case.
Thanks, Dan. So let's start where Dan finished, because that's where Judge Easterbrook began. So this is a case involving loans to an individual by a loan company that is based in a Native American territory. Have I got that right? Is that what you gathered? And that's going to play a role.
That is, I think, what's going on here.
And we're gonna it's going to play a role. We'll get to that issue because that's a separate issue. And what happened is one of the related entities to the defendants settled with the plaintiff in this putative class action for more than he could have gotten. In the class, and the individual could have gotten. In other words, they tried to pick them off. And pick off works in Illinois state court. It's a case called Barber. It's been reaffirmed by the Illinois Supreme Court. Works like a dream. Not so much in federal court. Illinois is an outlier in allowing pick off. It's unusual that Illinois has taken this position, but there's at least two attempts that have been made to the Illinois Supreme Court to get rid of its pickoff jurisprudence, and the court so far at least is not budging. So in Campbell Ewald, and I remember when this case was coming about, and it's a case, but it's an unsettled case. It's an offer. In other words, it's an offer of judgment under Rule 68, Federal Rule 68. Illinois does not have an equivalent of Federal Rule 68. So it's offering the person everything they could get, but that was an unaccepted offer. This was an accepted offer. Judge Easterbrook was incredulous that neither of the parties were prepared to talk about the mootness issue. I think it was counsel move along to go on to a different argument because I'm not buying what you're selling here. And it's always entertaining when Judge Easterbrook is sitting. And they then got on to the merits of the situation, and let's just say things didn't get much better. because counsel prior to the lawyers who were arguing for the defendant here didn't do much with the case. Is that fair to say? They answered the complaint. They answered three rounds of discovery. They didn't issue any discovery of their own. They didn't file affirmative defenses, including what is their defense now of arbitration. And then I think the client gets wind that this isn't going so well. We need to change horses. They change horses, and these new lawyers come in, and they, I think, almost immediately say, enough of this, arbitration, please. You got to arbitrate this. There's an arbitration clause, yada, yada. The circuit court, or strike that, the district court says, no dice, you've waived it, you went on for too long. It's a multi-factor test. I think it was Judge Easterbrook that says, once you're talking about factors, you lose. Because this is an abuse of discretion situation. The district court judge weighed the factors, they came out against you, you lose. And I don't remember who the district court judge is, it doesn't much matter. The district court judge said, no, you did do anything, you're out of luck. So they appeal this. Let's say they got a better ear, a more sympathetic ear from Justin Jackson Akawumi. She seemed to say, well, they didn't take any action other than answer the complaint. They didn't take advantage of anything from the district court. They didn't take actions that were inconsistent with arbitration. Yeah, they waited a while, but so what? I don't know if that will ultimately be her ruling or what her, you know, if she dissents in here, because Judge Rovner and Judge Easterbrook were not buying that there wasn't a waiver here. Or if they do buy it, it's they wanted to give the defense lawyers an awful hard time before they got there. They did give the lawyer an awful hard time. There's another issue that was raised, it seemed late in the game, as to which law applies. And this was another aspect of the situation that aggravated Judge Easterbrook. And that was, they argued that tribal law should apply. But the question is, what law do we use to do the choice of law analysis? There is no federal law on this point. Do we use tribal law? Do we use Illinois state law? What law, because this is the state where the court is sitting, the district court that is a sitting, what law do we use to tell us that tribal law should apply? And it's part of that analysis in nearly every choice of law analysis I'm aware of, you have to determine would there be a difference in outcome between the one set of law that's on the table and the other set of law that's on the table. And it seems in this case there was no law from the tribal law to give an answer to that question. So where are you going to look at it? It's not surprising that on a point of this kind, there isn't much development in the tribal law on this. It's a very discrete issue. There would be many states that would have development on an issue this narrow. This is only really becoming to the fore, you know, more recently in state. It certainly has developed in Illinois state court, in federal court, but in other states that have less commercial activity, they haven't developed this, and you wouldn't expect a tribal law to have a lot of development in this area. They don't have a ton of commercial activity to warrant this kind of sophisticated kind of analysis. It's not a criticism, but just the truth. And so they don't like, well, what is the tribal law? We don't know. We didn't. It's like, well, then what are we going to do? It doesn't seem to be very fruitful to say you would apply a law that doesn't seem to have any law on the topic. We're just going to make it up anyway. And where are we supposed to look to figure out what that law is? Probably back at, you know, states like Illinois that do have a developed law in this area. So it's a bit of a mess. The defendants seemingly had not the best counsel to start off with. Seems they've got very good counsel now, trying to make every argument available. And I'm not saying making arguments that are spurious, just making good arguments that probably should have been made earlier. And they're doing the best they can with a bad situation in trying to get this thing out of court and into arbitration. Dan, what are your thoughts?
I agree with you, Pat. And it's tribal law, I think, in a lot of instances. I know a few people that practice it in some states, especially out in the Western Plains and things. And Mary Smith, the current ABA president, was president of the Native American Bar Association. I think there's some in that arena, but like you said, I think it's not as developed just because some of these things are, you know, not a lot of disputes at that level. That's just what the reality. So this is always, you know, every time we have a chance to listen to and talk about Easterbrook cases, it's always, like you said, a couple of his pithy lines, and you know, it's not really intended to be pithy, that's just how he is. And so, you know, as soon as you go there, you lose, like you said. You know, he's pretty frank. I mean, and like you said, he's,
well, it's pun intended.
Yeah. And, you know, in this case, you know,
his parents named him that for a reason. They knew what they were gonna get.
Exactly. You know, in this case, you know, he, like you said, he may not be right if Oye is right on that case. You know, it may be a distinction, but
I'll be very interested to see what he has to say about it. You know,
me too.
I he was convinced that this is what it says. So far be it for me to argue with him about federal civil procedure. How about doing that? My brief look at it, it's like, I don't see how this is applying. I don't have enough of the facts. Let's see. But yeah. I want, because he has to address the mootness issue in their opinion. I'd be very interested to see what he says about it.
Me too. And who knows? Like I said, this could be a 2-1 decision, or we may be surprised in this one. We'll see.
Yeah, no, Justice Jackson Akwumi, I don't know, other than that she actually believes that there hasn't been a waiver, I don't know why she would make some of the comments that she made, especially given what Judges Rovner and Easterbrook said on the topic. You know, maybe they, you know, I think she was genuinely agreeing with the defendants and trying to get her colleagues to see, well, I think the defendants' arguments have some merit here. So
right.
And we'll see if she can change a couple minds, or at least one of their minds.
Yep.
So an interesting case, and one that'll be fun to take a look at. Hopefully it comes out sooner than one recently that was argued first in 2018, then in 2020, and just got decided last week. So hopefully we find out a bit sooner than 6 years. Because in 6 years, I hope we're still doing the podcast. But we might not be.
We might not be, and Easterbrook and Rovner might not be still judging. You know, hopefully they
Judge Rovner, as soon as her replacement gets appointed, is going on senior status.
Senior status,
Now, senior status for some doesn't mean very senior. Some of them still take an 80 or 90% load.
Right.
My understanding is that's the low Judge Flom has taken. So I can see Judge Rovner having a very heavy load.
I could too.
So we'll see what senior status means for Judge Rovner. All right. So with that, we'll take our first and only break of the show and be back with Purdue Farms.
Hey, Podiebin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to segment 2 of episode 200 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. And can a party for a party to a contract headquartered in the state chosen in the Forum Selection Clause argue that it is not bound by that provision based upon public policy concerns over multiple litigation in two states that could yield different results? That is the question to be addressed when the Indiana Supreme Court decides Purdue Farms, Inc. versus LMB Transport and others. Dan read the full caption earlier. You don't need to be subjected to that again. The court described the case thusly. U.S. Security Associates LLC contracted with Purdue Farms for security services. That contract required the parties to file any lawsuits arising from their agreement in Maryland. That's where Purdue Farms is based. After an incident in the plant, Purdue filed suit in Davis County Court, which granted U.S. Securities and its employees' motion to enforce the forum selection clause. On interlocutory appeal, the Court of Appeals reversed and remanded and vacated the circuit court. That's been now vacated because transfer has been granted. The Indiana Supreme Court granted transfer and assumed jurisdiction over the case. Dan, tell us about this case in a rather crazy situation.
A crazy situation indeed. The one of the things that was at play in the case that the Chief Justice and some of the other justices of the Indiana Supreme Court were asking advocates is there's U.S. securities, and then there's another that's got the
similarly same named,
and they're affiliated, and that raised
this was issues. Judge. I think this was Justice Slaughter that raised
Slaughter
this
was
issue.
Asking it.
No one else had raised it in any of the court, any of the cases, any of the judges, any of the parties. No one had raised this before.
Yeah, and what happened here was the employees of U.S. securities were allowed on the property, caused all kinds of damage, $1.3 million to the tune of it. A lot of chatter, Pat, between both advocates and, again, Slaughter and the Chief Justice were asking numerous questions about the fact that Purdue drafted this agreement, although they claim that they did not draft it, that it was mutually drafted. I mean, it's their contract. It's their third-party supplier contract, like I draft for clients all the time. And it made the selection of Maryland. I mean, that's what it did.
Purdue is a giant company. This is a small vendor. There is no way that this contract was negotiated between parties. And it's not a contract of adhesion, but it wasn't a mutually negotiated contract.
They may have got a couple concessions, but I've been up against. I think I've talked on here before about the big retail box chains or you big insurers. Like, yeah, you're not. If you were, if you're McDonald's, maybe Purdue. You have equal footing and there's special provisions, but not in this case, for sure. But what Purdue's arguing here is that they fear that they'll get whipsawed, that there'll be litigation in Maryland, litigation in Indiana, where the employees and some of the other stuff is, and they don't want to get whipsawed, that one venue, Indiana, should be the venue. I think it was Slaughter asked about the forum selection that your client proposed or demanded, and the appellant response was we're co-drafters. Issue here of concern of Purdue's, it didn't sound like the court was buying it very much. Just a lot of kind of pushback, a lot of questions. Appellant, the argument that they were arguing, like you said, Pat, it's not a contract of adhesion, but close. That they said that the other party admitted in brief in their equal footing. Purdue lawyer was arguing that these are not the private factors that are of concern here, but more the public factors, the judicial resources that might be at play, witnesses. We've talked about the public-private factors of forum in the past and how that all comes into play. Justice Slaughter, I think, again, was him. He made a comparison to the arbitration clause and how this is different. And Helen tried to argue that the Federal Arbitration Act applied, but again, I'm not sure how convincing that was. The real question is here why the contract shouldn't control that Maryland is the what's controlling. I think the choice of law here, though, is Indiana. But like I said, the appellants, the justices sure seem to have a lot to ask about with respect to the appellant, not so much as much the appellee. The other thing I think that's at play here, Pat, is that there hasn't been substantial discovery done. This is pretty early, I think, in the proceedings, if I'm recalling that right. And Justice Slaughter.
Yeah, unlike the last party, these people raised this issue right at early stages of the litigation, stages. Like you should have.
And I think one of the questions was, why should we not defer to the trial court and their decision making in these factors, and they decided how this was going to be handled, and so why should we not defer to the trial court on these decisions, the abuse of discretion standard? There was also some a question, I think it was Slaughter, but it may have been the Chief Justice that talked about, they talked about a ladder case, I think, that we covered in this show. The Justice asked about supervision control, the truck going through, and again, the appellant tried to distinguish between contractual privity and litigation privity, and I'm not sure I entirely followed that argument, to be honest, of what exactly the point was.
Well, I think what he was getting at is, are these individuals who aren't members or aren't signatories to the contract, are they going to be bound? And that was resolved when counsel for the appellee said, we're not going to challenge personal jurisdiction in Maryland. We're perfectly happy to go to Maryland.
Right.
And so all the this also deals with and wraps up the idea that there could be a multiplicity of litigation. It's like, no, we're all going to go to Maryland. We're going to decide this in Maryland, and we'll do it there.
That's it, right?
So that concession, such as it was, I think it could be dispositive.
Right. I think so. And then the appellee was asked about O'Brien, which is a case of whose burden it is to show that, you know, continuing litigation in a particular form would be unfair and unjust. And the appellee, I think, correctly responded that that's the burden of Purdue, right? Purdue's the one challenging the forum here. And again, Purdue's incorporated in Maryland. It's their contract that specifies Maryland. And again, it's not entirely clear what Purdue's real motivation is here for trying it in Indiana, other than the argument that the plant's in Indiana and that's where the injuries occurred.
Yeah, I don't understand why you pick Maryland and then you decide that you don't like it when you get sued, or you file suit and you want to, bring it somewhere else. I don't get that. I have a client, my biggest client. We put in a choice of forum of a place, and we stick to it. That's where we want to be, and do everything we can within the bounds of the law to litigate there.
And, you know, this happens.
It happens that that court's across the street from my office, which is convenient. But that's what we choose.
And that's, and most parties do it. Again, the parties that have more power in these contracts. And this gets, one of the things that I think gets negotiated as much as anything in these supplier and third-party agreements is choice of law and jurisdiction, and forum. That's and sometimes people will compromise in Delaware, New York, but that's what the contract says. Yeah, like you, I don't really understand how you argue that. It's kind of like a couple of weeks ago we had the arbitration case where we're subject to arbitration, and Samsung, right, that's fighting all the arbitrations that they're facing with the AAA for BIPA. Because they're single cases, but their contract says you have to file in AAA single cases because we don't want class actions. We don't want in federal court. So
fine, then you get 30,000 individual right. Actions. Enjoy.
And you're going to pay a lot of money.
You'll pay a lot of money.
Pay a lot for that muffler. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. There, you just dated yourself.
I did.
That's pretty good, though. Yeah. All right, so that brings us to, there's not much left in the show.
No.
There was no BI, BIPA, GIPA, IPA.
Nope.
There were no predictions. Dan is at 308, 63, and 24. I'm at 305, 66, and 24. See, we have done pretty good over the years.
Yep.
And that brings us to our predictions for this week. I think that Al Nahas wins in that case. I think that gets affirmed.
I think
I think Purdue loses and that gets affirmed. The trial card gets affirmed.
I think so. Yep.
All right. Which brings us to it's appropriate given the frequency with which we've cited Corey Webster, who's a partner at Dykema's LA office and an appellate lawyer out there, that we go with Corey of the week. Dan, tell us about the Corey of the week.
Yeah, this is one that was that both of us, I think, saw. It's has to do with the California Supreme Court and Ninth Circuit. Corey wrote, "What's the best way to get a state high court to take a case? The answer might be to get into federal court. In civil cases, the California Supreme Court grants review in about 3% of cases. Not great odds, but there's another path. California law allows federal appellate courts to ask the California Supreme Court to answer questions of state law. Like with regular petitions for review, the California Supreme Court has no obligation to grant a federal court's request, but in practice, the vast majority of these requests are granted. Up until last week, in the past 6 years, the California Supreme Court granted over 90% of the Ninth Circuit's certification request, 21 in total. So he finishes with 90% greater than 3%. And we covered one of these. It was the business interruption case last week was on certification, was it?
Yeah, it was. It was on certification for the Ninth Circuit. As if there weren't enough cases in the California system all by themselves, they ended up taking one from the Ninth Circuit.
Yeah, and this, you know, I don't know what the stats are in Illinois, but the thing we talked about this as well, Seventh Circuit on a BIPA insurance case.
Caprone, think of Alexander, which was a contribution case.
I'm talking about the insurance case, though, where the Illinois appellate David Ellis said, "No, you're wrong," and now.
I see.
Now the Seventh Circuit's not become gun shy, but there's been a few. We've seen a few more in recent weeks where they just say they certified a question after that said, here, there's three potential questions. You can frame the questions.
Well, yeah, I think that one's a little different, though, because that's one purely, and that's the third I was getting. So there's been three that I can think of since we've been doing the show that have been certified by the Seventh Circuit, all of which have been taken by the Illinois Supreme Court. So they took the Alexander case, which was a contribution. They took the Cathrone case, which was on BIPA. And they've taken now this case, Martin versus Goodrich, which is on under the Illinois Due Process Clause, the Due Process Clause of the Illinois Constitution, not the federal Constitution, and the meaning of the Occupational Disease Act. Those are truly unique Illinois questions of Illinois law.
They are.
The question, you know, I posed this in a comment to Corey, is that, so yeah, you can get yourself to federal court, but if you're the plaintiff and you file in federal court and then you ask the court to certify a question, that seems a bit disingenuous, because if you wanted a state court to decide the issue, you could have filed it in state court. The case is removed, that's a different kettle of fish. And this came up in one of the cases. One of the BIPA BI cases in the Ninth Circuit, where the plaintiff filed in federal court and then asked for certification. The judge is like, "What are you talking about? You filed here. You obviously want us to decide it. If you wanted the state court to decide it, you would have filed in state court. So you can't have it both ways."
Right.
So I agree with him in principle. The question is how you get there.
Yeah.
It's still very difficult to get a question certified. It's you still have a hurdle to overcome.
Yeah.
Also, in Illinois, at least, they do not take certifications from any courts but the Supreme Court of the United States or the Seventh Circuit.
Right.
So if you're in any other circuit or you are in a district court, no dice.
Right.
There are some states that will take certified questions from any court, any federal court. And one of the BI cases from the Ohio Supreme Court was from a district court in the Northern District of Ohio that certified it to the Ohio Supreme Court. So there's Illinois has a very strict rule under Rule 20 as to who they will take certification from. I don't know why they limit it to just the Seventh Circuit. Obviously, it's most likely that a Seventh Circuit is going to hear a case that concerns Illinois law, but it's not out of the question that, one of the other circuits could hear an issue of Illinois law.
A good example, again, is BIPA in the big Facebook settlement that was in the Ninth Circuit, right?
And, excellent example. Right? And they couldn't certify the question.
Right.
So I don't know, is there a mechanism under the federal rules for the Ninth Circuit to certify a question to the Seventh Circuit so they can certify it? It's like bouncing off things.
I'm not aware of it.
I'm not aware of it either. I don't know why Rule 20 is as narrow as it is. I'm sure there's a reason. I just don't know what it is.
I don't either.
But you're right about it. I didn't think about the BIPA, but that case was pending out in the Ninth Circuit in California, and then went to the Ninth Circuit. Plainly involves a question of Illinois law. I don't know. So a very interesting issue of procedure, which is what we do here. So
it is.
So with that, that's all we have for this week. We'll see everybody next week on the Podium and Panel Podcast.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel Podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.